Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with J. Richard Rick Gruber, author of Dusty Manger, Art and Life. We'll also hear from Monique Trung, whose new book is The Sweetest Fruits. J. Richard Gruber, Rick, is the Director Emeritus of the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. Now he's an independent art historian, writer, and curator. He's published many books and catalogs about artists and architects. And today we're talking about his most recent, Dusty Manger, Art and Life, Biloxi, New Orleans, New York. Rick, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Very happy to be here and to be talking to you again.
First of all, what a life Dusty Manger led, and what a beautiful book to honor that life.
Of all the artists I've worked with, and many over the years, I think he had one of the most fascinating lives of all. That's really what ended up driving the development of the book and layout of the book, and of course the way Philip Collier did such a grand job of designing and using so many of the historic images we were able to find, covering a life that spanned the years from 1903 to 1993, the 20th century, essentially.
I know, so amazing. So tell us how Eunice Lyle Sweatman, the daughter of a Biloxi banker, became the artist Dusty Manger. It's such a journey.
Sounds like a film script.
It does, doesn't it?
Well, she was raised with one foot in the Old South, much history, tradition, as that daughter of a banker, but she wanted to be an actress from early on, and she actually staged small productions in the front of their house and pulled in scenery and environment from her yards and charged, I think, a nickel or something, and put on productions, wanted to be an actress, but her father wanted her to, being a proper young woman in his estimation in the early 20th century, go to college. So she agreed finally to go to Blue Mountain College, but being precocious, she went there at the age of 16. She graduated at the age of 19, and she finished college with a degree in 2.5 years. And then her father had to relent and let her go to become an actress, which she did in Chicago in 1922. And since she was 19, she had to claim that she was 21 so that she could legally travel in stage productions at Chautauqua and like around the country. Mm-hmm. And there she first met Archie Manger, who was an artist and an art student at Chicago Art Institute. They connected again in New York when she was on the stage and films there, and eventually they married in 1928, and it kind of went from there.
And her art evolved so much over time. She began by working alongside Archie.
She did, and Archie began to realize that she had a remarkable natural talent. In fact, encouraged her not to go to art school because he'd gone to most of the good ones and thought they might ruin her innate talent. So basically, she studied a bit with Archie, and that was it.
And after he died, and he died so young, she set about it even more resolutely.
She did. He died in 1936 of what we think now was Lou Gehrig's disease. And she decided to take over the studio, to stay in their property, and to devote herself seriously this time to being an artist. And from 1936 to 1939, produced, I think, a remarkable body of work, as you see in the book. Everything from traditional still lives, but quickly into a wide range of self-portraits, but remarkable images of what she saw in and around Biloxi, the harbors, the hotels, the seafood factories, the people who lived there, and an increasingly modernist, then surreal vision that helped her get her first show in New York in 1939, 3 years after she started painting as an artist.
Now, she was very much a part of the Gulf Coast art scene. She knew the Anderson family, for example, and I love that she went to Shearwater and made designs for plates.
Aren't those great?
They really are.
How many things can you do with a circle? Let me show you.
Yeah, right.
And I had a great talk with Mary Anderson, the son of Walter Anderson, Bob Anderson, in the process of this book, working on one of the many good interviews I was able to have. sitting on the steps at Shearwater talking about that process, how many people took those classes with her grandmother, and Dusty was one of them. And they all, you know, the winner of each of those classes would have a plate cast, and Dusty was one of those. But she was very proud of that connection, and Walter Anderson, of course, was the best man in their wedding. So Walter and Archie, her husband, were good friends. So she was connected and remained connected to that family and that Shearwater position the rest of her life.
And then she had such an influential art dealer and friend in Betty Parsons in New York.
Yes, I mean, there's a book in that alone, to be honest.
Wouldn't there be? Oh, man.
Betty's just an amazing personality. I encountered Marjorie Liebman and Dorothy Sturm in Memphis when I was director of the Books Museum back in the 80s, and they talked about they were part of her gallery. They talked about what she did in the South, how she came through, and her impact, her friendship with Dusty lasted from the late 40s up until the time Betty died in 1982. They were very close, and Betty had a great deal to do with the advancement of her career in New York with some of the best artists in her gallery, and also just raising the stature of so many important women who somehow, sadly, not unlike Dusty, should be much better known today than they are because they were then.
There's a painting of Betty's in the Ogden Museum right now. It's part of this exhibit. So you get a sense of her artistic sensibility as well.
She was very talented, and as a dealer, never was prone to showing her own art, but other dealers did show it, and she's had a lot of exhibitions, catalogs in the last 5 or 10 years, looking back at her career, too.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Rick Gruber about Dusty Bonger, Art and Life, Biloxi, New Orleans, New York. We'll be right back. In your subtitle, you talk about these three places, Art and Life, Biloxi, New Orleans, New York. So talk about Dusty's friends in New Orleans who were so wide-ranging.
They were. You're right. She essentially grew up in some ways going back and forth to New Orleans. Her mother's family was from Louisiana, and she had relatives there. So she grew up in and out of New Orleans. But in the art world, early on, one of the artists that she knew, a friend of Archie's again, too, was Paul Nunez. They'd been long-term friends. And, of course, the Andersons. And then, especially, I think, importantly for this conversation, is in the mid-50s, the group around the Orleans Gallery. That was Georgia Dunbar, Bob Helmer, Gene Seidenberg, Lynn Emery, Jack Hastings, Shirley Grode Helmer, and then later others. She became very close to that group, especially George Dunbar and Bob Helmer. And she did sort of break her vow to Archie and did study briefly at their 331 gallery. So she was already exhibiting in New York, but she did do that. And she admitted it later that, you know, Archie probably wasn't happy. But she thought it was important, and she loved being a part of that context and environment. She kept an apartment in the French Quarter off and on. Her son Lyle was photographing in the French Quarter, Mardi Gras. He's well known for those images. And she became more and more a part of what I think was a very important and still under-recognized nationally art scene, that modernist art scene that developed from the mid-50s on in New York and in New Orleans.
Her work, to me, is so varied and interesting. One of the things I was especially drawn to were the portraits of women, which are so bold and colorful. There's one particular self-portrait of her that's kind of fractured, you know what I mean, with green planes around her eyes, and it's just really striking.
She did a series of those. They were very, very strong. And then a few years later, by the early 40s, she did a self-portrait just looking down at her feet. Titled self-portrait. So there you go. What is a self-portrait? It's what I say is a self-portrait.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was this early influence by the Cubist, and then on to the Keyhole people of the Surrealists.
Yeah, especially in the Depression era, she didn't travel to New York as much. After the war, she did, but she stayed in touch with what was happening in the museums, the galleries. She read the books. She was very immersed in the thinking around the emerging abstract expressionist, and immersed herself in surrealism, and in the early 50s especially was kind of working away through that towards becoming a full-blown abstract expressionist, which she was doing from, say, 1952, 54, 55, 56. She really followed the trail that many of those artists did. And she stayed in touch with Betty Parsons, so I'm sure suggested what was happening and she should pay attention to it. She did.
Well, it's so interesting to me because you look through the book and there's a beautiful painting of a seafood factory where the seafood factory workers lived. There are incredible cemeteries. I feel like I would know one of her cemeteries anywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you would. You would. And I think one of the things I hope comes through in this book is her connection to place, that famous Southern phrase of sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
Hers was there. It was Biloxi at the Gulf Coast. And I thought about Eudora Welty and her connection to place, her house and her garden, and thought about Mr. Faulkner and his ties to Oxford and to Roanoke. And that's a common thing in Mississippi, and I think Dusty needs to be considered in the same context. Her tie to place was very, very important.
Right. In those abstract expressionist paintings, there's a whole series of paintings that she called voids,
yes,
which I thought were so interesting. And there's a fabulous film of her from Mississippi Public Broadcasting, Dusty Bonger, The Life of an Artist, that you can watch on YouTube. And you can actually see her painting one of those voids.
Isn't that remarkable?
It is.
I mean, going over and over through all this material for years, I kept going back to that film, and
mm-hmm.
there she is beginning one of the first of the void paintings at the beginning of that film, showing you how she works, how she thinks. Her grandson, Paul, who was a great help in this project, he was very close to her, talked about how influenced she and Lyle and Paul were by Buddhism, and one of the things they talked about was a notion of a void or a clearing of the mind in Buddhism, and that is what he credits the beginning of that series, all of them circular, and all of them having that kind of brushstroke that we see in a lot of Japanese Buddhist inkbrush drawings.
Mm-hmm. You can just stare at it forever. And she made objects, sculptures as well.
She was so busy.
That's an underestimate.
I got tired keeping up with her. And I thought she would slow down some in her old years. She did exactly the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Her later career in her 60s and 70s and even well into her 80s, she was always experimenting. She was creating objects. She was sewing. She became immersed in fiberglass, helping Lyle work on one of his boats, and learned from the key people on the Gulf Coast, Bill Siemens, about how to actually work color into fiberglass, and created fiberglass windows. You saw two of those at the Ogden exhibition that were received quite well in her last show at Betty Parsons Gallery in 1975, using new materials and creating something like an abstract, expressive stained glass window.
Mm-hmm. It's so beautiful. I'm curious, why do you think she never married again? She was widowed so young, and she was such a great beauty. Do you think it was that Archie was truly the love of her life?
That's a question I asked over and over again, and that's usually the response I got. It's a very good question. She was quite striking. She had no lack of admirers and suitors and connections and affiliations of all sorts along those lines, but she never did remarry. And Archie, when you look at those photographs we were able to find well into the process of Archie and Dusty in New York and their young son, some of them up on the rooftop of their building in New York, they looked so incredibly happy.
Yeah.
They moved to Biloxi in what they thought was probably an idyllic paradise. By the time they moved there, in the studio, they had a house, they had a child, they were ready to have an amazing life, and it just stopped a couple
mm-hmm.
years after they moved there. And I think she never got over that, and I think Archie was always with her in many ways, including looking over her shoulder while she's at the easel and the studio he built.
Now, another thing I admire about her, I mean, she's very much a woman to discover now, because she did it all. She did marriage, she did art, she did motherhood. She was both of her time in some ways and way ahead of it.
Exactly. I think that's very well stated, and I think that's one of the things that really struck me about this project and the timing of it. There's been a major refocusing even in the process, which started about 2014, 2015. And in the period since this started, major exhibitions of abstract expressionism, one called Women Abstract Expressionism of Abstract Expressionism, came out of the Denver Art Museum and Ninth Street Women, another major book. There's a great deal of focus
right
on leading and often less known women of that era, who often were way ahead of their times, and Dusty was in many respects. And yet one thing I really noticed in looking at the photographs and working on this and reading her letters and journals, she was very happy. In general, she was a very happy person.
Mm-hmm.
She had a very happy life with a family, with a child, with grandchildren. And if you look at those photographs in the book, quite often she was surrounded by a very interesting range of people, whether it's family, friends, visitors. She was always the center of a very active, engaged group on the Gulf Coast.
What an inspiration, and what a beautiful book. We've been talking with Rick Gruber, whose gorgeous new book is Dusty Bonger, Art and Life, Biloxi, New Orleans, New York. Sunday, September 8th, is the final day for the exhibit at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art, and it is wonderful. Rick, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's fun to talk to you.
Monique Trung is the author of two novels, the critically acclaimed The Book of Salt, about a Vietnamese cook who worked for Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas in Paris in the 20s, and Bitter in the Mouth, about a young woman making her way in a North Carolina town. We're speaking to her today from her home in Brooklyn about her third novel, The Sweetest Fruits. Monique, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. The Sweetest Fruits is a novel that will appeal so much to New Orleans readers. First, because it's so beautifully written, but secondly, because it's about Lafcadio Hearn, who lived from 1850 to 1904. So how did you first encounter his work? He's such a great story.
I came across him as an entry into the new Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, and a particular volume focused on food waste. And I was fact-checking the use of sugar in cornbread recipes in the South versus the North, and I came across his name and a really short biographical, you know, sort of entry on him. And frankly, none of the things that were written about him made sense to me. That he had written the first Creole cookbook, that he then, you know, moved to Japan and became an expert on Japanese folklore and ghost stories and fairy tales. It just seemed just too much for one man.
It is a lot. Now, you've adopted a brilliant strategy, which is to show him through the eyes of the women in his life. And you begin with his mother, Rosa Casamati. So tell us about these women.
The women, I think, started to really emerge from the biography that I was reading on Hearn. My sense of them was that it was all based on hearsay, you know. And as a former lawyer, I don't trust hearsay. So specifically, let's take the example of Rosa. Rosa could not read or write. I wonder where these biographers got notions that she was, for example, childish and impetuous. And those were sort of the questions that started to emerge from me. And the same was true with the second voice in the novel, which is Lafcadio Hearn's first wife, who was an African-American woman, a formerly enslaved person whom he met in Cincinnati, Ohio. She also could not read or write. So again, the questions of source as well as sort of assumption, which I think were more in play with the stories of the women in his life than Hearn, because of course we know that Hearn was just a voluminous letter writer, as well as just being incredibly prolific. With Hearn's life, it was very much something that came from him, while the women were more or less dependent on other people telling their stories. And I wanted, in this novel, to invite them to the table.
And the third woman in his story is one of the most compelling in this book.
I'm so glad you think that, Susan.
Oh, I loved her.
Yeah, so the third voice was Lafcadio Hearn's second wife. And he met and married her in Japan. And she actually is one of the rare exceptions in that she did leave a document to us, which was her memoir of her life with Hearn. Even in that instance, because Setsu was writing in Japanese, she was dependent on her translators in order to basically provide us with the final text that we know her through. And I had questions about their translations because even though I fully admit I have no fluency in Japanese, I was sensing that there was something that was rather flat about how she was telling her story. That was also another area where I wanted to do more research and sort of just answer for myself whether this setsu that we know through this translated memoir is a version or is in fact a reflection of the woman herself.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Monique Trung, whose new book is The Sweetest Fruits. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm speaking with Monique Trung, whose new book is The Sweetest Fruits. Now, you bring such passion and insight to writing about food. You do a lot of writing about food besides in your fiction. You write a lot of nonfiction. In this book, there's so much, you know, cornbread, sugared almonds, soft eggs and toast. And food is tied to so many other things, love and sustenance and memory of home. That must be so much fun for you as a writer, especially when you're following in the steps of this man who creates this landmark cookbook.
It is so much fun, just because that's what I think about all the time anyway, which is food. So I try to find subjects that will allow me to explore the theme of food, but in different ways. And with Lafcadio Hearn's story, I think very early on, it became clear to me that his story was actually more about hunger. Hearn had periods in his life very early on. When I say early on, I mean early on in his adulthood. And then also when he first arrived in New Orleans, he was very poor and hungry. So it made perfect sense to think about him opening a restaurant called The Hard Time, where everything cost only 5 cents.
Right.
Right? And also that he would write a cookbook. When I thought about him through the lens of hunger, that started to make sense to me. That element of him began to make sense for me.
Well, he's always been so special as an eccentric figure in our letters. I love that he was one of the first literary editors for a newspaper in town. I love his woodcuts. He was an extraordinary visual artist as well.
Yeah.
And there's this famous picture of him as a line drawing, and he's getting ready to leave, and it's his back is to the viewer, and he's wearing a coat, and he's holding his suitcase. And even in this little drawing, you can tell he's short and burdened. And I've always been charmed by that, that he's just heading off for his next adventure, wherever it might take him.
I know exactly the woodcut you're talking about. And I had that on my writing table as I was sort of following him around the globe. I am, as you know, that suitcase of his appears in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a constant, right?
Right.
Constant.
I love that. Lovable and exasperating, to be sure. Oh, Lafcadio Hearn. We've been talking with Monique Trung, whose elegant new novel, her third, is The Sweetest Fruits. So beautiful. Monique, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Susan, for having me on.
Here's is what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Adam Chandler discusses in Sign's Drive-Through Dreams, a journey through the heart of America's fast food kingdom. Sunday, September 8th at 2 at Octavia Books. Tenny Flynn of G.W. Finn's discusses in Sign's The Deep End of Flavor, recipes and stories from New Orleans' premier seafood chef. Tuesday, September 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. The third quarterly reading of Why There Are Words, curated by Liz Green, features six local writers, Elizabeth Mickey Brenna, C.W. Cannon, Nicole Iden, Angela Mitchell, Tom Piazza, Kimberly Ann Southwick, on the theme of memory. Wednesday, September 11th at 6 at Octavia Books, voluntary donation at the door. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses The Only Story by Julian Barnes, Wednesday, September 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Historian Carolyn Cobb will lead a six-part series titled The History of Jefferson Parish, beginning Wednesday, September 11th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library, 2781 Manhattan Boulevard in Harvey. The topic for the first session is Jefferson Parish, from prehistoric times to the Louisiana Purchase and Parish Formation. W. Caleb McDaniel discusses in Sign's Sweet Taste of Liberty, a true story of slavery and restitution in America, Thursday, September 12th at 6:30 at Octavia Books. S. Derby Gisclair discusses in Sign's The Olympic Club of New Orleans, epicenter of professional boxing, 1883 to 1897, Thursday, September 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. William Ken Kruger discusses and signs his novel, This Tender Land, Friday, September 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship begins its reading of The Old Curiosity Shop with a discussion of chapters 1 through 10, Saturday, September 14th at 2 at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. And coming up later this month, the New Orleans Advocate and Garden District Bookshop present Candace Bushnell, whose new book is There Still Sex in the City? Tuesday, September 17th at 7 at the New Orleans Advocate, 840 St. Charles Avenue. This is a ticketed event. Tickets are available at Garden District Bookshop. Blue Cypress Books hosts a sneak peek at coming fiction. Jamie Attenberg reads from All This Could Be Yours, due out in November, and Katie Simpson-Smith reads from The Everlasting, coming in March 2020. The reading takes place Thursday, September 19th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Letters Read, curated by Nancy Sharon Collins, presents a reading of The Letters of the Baroness Pontalba, Wednesday, September 25th at 5:30 at the State Museum, 701 Charters. And Happy Birthday, Mr. Faulkner, runs September 24th through 26th at the Cabildo and the Hotel Peter and Paul. The theme for 2019 is the American experience in literature and life, including a talk by Faulkner biographer Jay Perini. The big read author for this event is Tayari Jones, author of An American Marriage, who appears in conversation with Maurice Carlos Ruffin, author of We Cast a Shadow. The featured Faulkner title is The Wild Palms. For more information and complete schedule, go to faulknersociety.org. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.